What I'm going to be doing this morning is trying to give a big picture, to try to share with you what it has taken me years as a slow learner to comprehend. I have, in the years I've been teaching this subject, usually covered this in classroom sessions anywhere from 40 to 60 hours, so it won't be too easy to put it all into a few minutes. But I think it's important to realize that the details are not important. It's the overall picture of what God is doing that's important, because you can read, all of us, I suppose, can read. How many can read? There's no use me telling you what's in books, and you can put in the details later if you get the overall picture so you know where you are. You have a feel for what's happening and where the details fit in. In order to do that, I'd like to just identify two or three little technical details which will give perspective to what I describe. I might as well start from the end first and go backwards. Some of you have no idea what it is that I'm doing. Someone said to me, "Well, how is your school?" And I said, "What school?" And they say, "Well, you know, they got what I'm doing confused with Fuller Seminary and so forth." Now, let me just very quickly, in 30 seconds, give you a rundown of what's going on where I come from, so you know the perspective from which I speak. The center which we occupy physically is 35 acres, 100 buildings, half of it's a campus, formerly the Pasadena Nazarene College campus. Half of it is residential properties, 85 residential properties. Has a large auditorium, largest in Pasadena, a brand new library building used 1 year before the college moved to San Diego, dormitories, classroom buildings, administration buildings, and so forth. It's in northeast Pasadena. Financially, it's a $15 million set of properties. We own it. But we owe still $10 million. That means our net worth is $5 million. And that seems pretty safe and secure, but it really isn't. We could, by the time I get home, we could discover that they had foreclosed and that we would lose, we would be back to square zero. Socially, we are 207 full-time people. Two-thirds of these are working in member organizations. One-third, about 60, 70, something like that, are in our central core, which we call coordinating staff. We have cooperating staff and coordinating staff. Our cooperating staff are members of other organizations. We have 32 different organizations on the campus. We even have one office occupied by a navigator. I don't know what he's doing, but that's all right. I don't know what most of the people there are doing. I just sort of like a janitor of the property. Our coordinating staff, our central staff, has grown from, these are December 31st dates, in 76, 5, 77, 31, 78, 52, 79, 55, 80, December 31st, 80, 77. And we're picking up about one person per week at this point. Our financial a net worth, I mentioned it was $5 million today. It was $100 at the end of 76. It was $600 at the end of that the next year, $1.2 million, $2 million, and $5 million at the end of 80. Now, what is our function? Our task is primarily to work for the benefit of the U.S. evangelical community as a strategy and mobilization center, focusing on the final frontiers. But we also maintain contact with 45 overseas offices worldwide that are concerned about the same frontiers. Now, by strategy and mobilization, strategy I mean field strategy. That is to say, overseas strategy, what it takes, what are the people groups to reach, and how can they be reached? The focus is upon the non-Christian world. By mobilization, I mean stirring up the Christian people. All the different constituencies, the churches, students, and the mission agencies. We're working primarily with mission agencies, secondarily with churches and students. How do we operate? We operate, as I've also already hinted, as a cooperative center where anybody, navigators, anybody is welcome to come and join us if, not just rent property, but if they're interested in joining into this kind of a center focused on frontiers. One mission executive said, we send one man there, we get back the work of 10 men. It will soon be more than that. Organizationally, we are like a mission agency. That is to say, in terms of the mission society tradition, which isn't perhaps exactly the same as Navigators or Crusade, but some similarities. There are no distinctions in pay. There is an equality. There's no distinctions of age or sex in assignment. For instance, a married couple, we would not take into membership just the husband. The wife would be taken in equally and also assigned and expected to be involved. Of course, with small children, that assignment might be much less formidable. All of our members are commissioned. As far as the U.S. government is concerned, they will be treated as ordained ministers. This is a new development within the mission world, which I've been trying to promote for years, attempting to make the case that a disciplined Protestant missionary order should be treated by the U.S. government just like a Roman Catholic order should be treated. We are a community. We seek to minister to each other. We are a work-study community. Among other things, we operate our own university, which has students all over the world. Well, so much for my background and the present. How did I get there? What are the key discoveries that brought me here? Let me spend 5 more minutes talking about some of the key terms before we plunge into this overall picture. Dr. McGavran came from India, where the country is honeycombed by social distinctions called castes in the old days, no longer legally referred to, but very much alive to this very moment. And as a result, he was more acutely sensitive to social differences in other countries. And McGavran's, I wouldn't say is his main contribution, but one of his main contributions, Donald McGavran, many of you must know him, he's associated with the phrase church growth, but he has allowed people, navigators, others in every part of the world, to be alert to the things that make communication difficult or easy. And the idea of working within people groups is the strategy that is dominating mission thinking today, so that the references to countries, except for purposes of visas, is waning in significance. And we are now rediscovering the fact that the Bible never uses a single word in Hebrew or Greek which can properly be translated country. Now, that doesn't mean that the Bible is against political entities called countries. It just means that God is not using any strategic outreach, as far as the Bible is concerned, to anything but nations. Now you say, well, nations, that's what a country is. Well, only recently in the English language has the word nation been used as a synonym for country. The word nation for most of the history of the English language, and the word in the Bible translated by the word nation, does not mean country. It means something smaller. India is a country of 3,000 nations. And to just give you a hint of what we'll talk about this evening, of those 3,000 nations of India, only 21 have any substantial number of Christians within them. Less than 100 have any Christians at all. 2,900 nations of India have no Christians at all. So when you start ticking off the countries, you know, just realize you're not working along the lines of biblical perspective. God has sent us not to the countries of the world, but to the nations of the world. The second key insight that took me a long time to figure out, even though I was a missions professor for 10 years, was the fact that the word missionary, if it's based upon the role of the Apostle Paul, probably does not belong to most people who call themselves missionaries today, And it probably describes equally well other people who are not normally called missionaries. Now, what I mean by that is, I remember waking up with a start to the fact that Paul, though considered a missionary, he's sort of the classical missionary, he never learned a foreign language, he never went to a foreign country. How could he be a missionary? Well, I think if we understand the role of Paul and identify it as a missionary role, we have got to quit talking about people who go to foreign countries as missionaries, necessarily, though some of them are, and we have to start talking about other people who don't go away, who don't learn a foreign language, and who don't leave their country as missionaries. It is very important, in fact, whether you use the word in this way, to understand what it was that Paul was doing that was unique and different from Peter. And Galatians 2:7 distinguishes the ministries of those two people in typically confusing language. If we don't know the Jewish situation, it says that Peter's ministry is to the circumcision and Paul's is to the uncircumcision. Well, what does that mean to a modern American? That is gobbledygook. It would be much simpler to just translate it. Peter's ministry was to his own people, and Paul's ministry was to people who were not his own. Now, you say, well, you see, unless you knew that both of them were Jews, you wouldn't gather that from that the literal translation. But furthermore, Paul was not merely a minister to people not his own. He was doing, for the first time, the planting of a fellowship of believers, an indigenous fellowship within that group of people who were not his own. Had there already been a group there in those particular Gentile communities, then his role would not have been so strategic. And so all of a sudden, we can develop a priority here that going where there is no previous penetration has got to be a higher priority than going where there are already Christians. And this is the distinction between Peter and Paul's ministry, as well as the fact that Paul was dealing with people who were not his own. Dealing with people not your own is essential if you're going to go where there are no Christians, because your own people, you're one Christian already, see? And presumably you're coming from a fellowship of believers that speak the language, who operate as Christians within your own culture. And if that's the case, then your culture has been penetrated. And the only way you can penetrate a culture for the first time is to go to somebody else. But if somebody else's culture has already been penetrated, then why not go someplace else? Now, let me give you an example. There are, and I have to really telescope this so we get on to the subject in the morning. There are roughly 16,750 nations where there is not yet any viable Christian fellowship within them. That's the number of mission fields, using the word mission by this definition, 16,750. Now, going there for the first time, breaking into that culture, is an exceedingly difficult job. Last night we heard about the clumsy problems of Indonesia, or today about the fact that you got to watch out what your name is, even going into French. These are unexpected problems which you cannot anticipate, and it is not a holier task. It is a harder task. But suppose you were, as a team, a worldwide team, to establish 17,000, to make it round number, instead of 16,750, suppose you were to establish 17,000 new fellowships of believers that minister to each other and to reach out to their own people, using their own language, operating within their own culture, which isn't going to be the same way we operate. This is the reason for shifting gears culturally as you go overseas, and the reason for shifting gears when you go across culturally within the United States. And suppose you were to establish in the next 17 weeks 17,000 new fellowships. They said, well, we couldn't do that. 17,000 in the next 17 weeks? Guess what? The family of believers around the world, the evangelical movement of this world, will establish 17,000 new churches in the next 17 weeks. That's how big this operation is. It's bigger than the Navigators. They'll establish 17,000 new churches in the next 17 weeks. This is just a statistical fact, barring, you know, the end of the world in 16 weeks or something. But now notice, only 4 or 5 of those churches will be in nations where there is no church. 16,995 of those churches will be within the nations already penetrated. Is that good strategy? Now you can imagine my own, how dumbfounded I was and startled and shocked and eventually blasted out of my professorship at Fuller Seminary when I discovered that single fact. That almost all Christian workers are working where there are already established fields. Very few are working beyond the limits of their social context. Now, see how important it is to give a special name, and I don't care what you call them. If you want to call them missionary, I would be pleased, but maybe you better not because no one else will understand you. We have to have a special name for these people whose special task is to break through into a nation, a sub-nation, where there is no fellowship of believers. Now, all of a sudden, it means, this is my third point, that the so-called impossible task of missions, I grew up, you've grown up, many of you may to this moment still think in terms of missions, you know, let's be honest, as a hopeless task. You work away at it, you do your part, the Midwest Division has done more than the Pacific Division. Ain't that great, see? And just, you know, relax a little because, you know, the Midwest Division is doing its part. But who expects us to ever win the world to Christ? Now, winning every last individual to Christ is not the same task, strategically or actually, as penetrating every last one of the remaining nations. The former task, I'll grant you, involves 3 billion people who are non-Christians, plus another 1 billion Christians that need Christ. That is a formidable task. But the mission task, this, what I consider the highest priority task, is to give people a chance who have no chance whatsoever, unless something different happens. That is not at this moment on the way to happening even, except in the last few years. And so, breaking into those cultures is the missionary task, and it is not impossible. This can be done by the year 2000. I would like to leave with you this technical term, closure. I would hope that every one of you would begin to think and reach out in faith to believe in a strategy of closure. I think Doss Trotman would talk in terms of a strategy of closure if he was in our situation in the world today. In his day, he and I and all the rest of us just thought of the world as it's just an unending, you know, like Napoleon going into Russia. You just never get there. But you do your duty. And duty is worth doing. I'm not decrying dutiful discipleship. But let's plan to finish this job of breaking in by the year 2000. It is not impossible. But the 17,000 new churches, the 17,000 new fellowships established are not going to have to be specially placed with strategy and special thinking that will not happen under the normal circumstances of people using their own intuition and their own natural outreach in evangelism. It will take special plans and so forth. Okay. Then finally, the most recent and astonishing reinterpretation for me has been the Bible itself. I grew up with a Bible. It happened to be a Scofield Bible. It had guideposts and notes all the way through, and it was a wonderful Bible. That's the Bible that I colored in all the verses I'd memorized. The verses that I'd hoped to memorize, I would just outline them in a faint tinting and hope to fill them in later. And you page through that Bible, and it shows the riches that I was able to mine from the Bible throughout those years. But I must confess, I didn't really understand this book. I referred to the books of the Bible. I still do by habit, but I don't consider them books anymore, but just chapters. This is just a single book. Furthermore, if this book were to be reprinted, and we're in the process of doing this, you could peel off the first 11 chapters and call them the introduction, no less a part of the book, but just the introduction to the whole book, not to the book of Genesis. These first 11 chapters talk about the creation that was good and beautiful, the fall of man, and then the hopelessness of man struggling with his sin. That's the introduction to this book. And you come up to the end of that introduction, which covers who knows how much time, and you arrive at the doorstep of a man named Abraham, and then the storyline of the Bible begins. The Bible then begins with chapter 12 of Genesis. That is to say, the main story of the Bible begins. Now, please don't think I'm trying to demote the first 11 chapters. What is the story? Now, there's a movie that was going around called The Empire Strikes Back. And as I gather, the Star Wars movie ended with good triumphing. The second movie starts out with evil lashing back. Well, the Bible is the other way around. The Bible begins with evil triumphing. And then the story, which you could call The Kingdom Strikes Back, begins in chapter 12. And it begins, the very first command is go. You know, I don't know if I'm, this is not, Freudian slip or anything. It just happens to be go from your country, from your relatives, from your father's house. And this missionary call to Abraham was a strategy which then carries us to the end of the book of Revelation and, in fact, carries us right down to the present day. It's all one story then, from then on. I used to get all interested in dispensations and the switching of the rules and things like that. And I think there is a great value in noticing periods and so forth. But I think there's also a great value in noticing continuity. And the continuity is there, and it was not my words, but it was I'm not a qualified Bible scholar. I only went to cemetery like everybody else who's ordained, and so I didn't really learn most of what I'm telling you in seminary. I have to lean back on a qualified Bible scholar to back me up when I say anything really outrageous. I was talking that there is one book recently, in the last year and a half, I've really been restudying all this. I've studied the Old Testament more in the last year and a half than I did in all the rest of my life. And I bought probably $300 worth of the latest technical books on the Old Testament to see what scholars are saying about key passages. For the most part, they don't say anything. One book I ran into called Towards an Old Testament Theology by Walter Kaiser Jr., Academic Dean of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School at Deerfield, north of Chicago, is different from almost all the rest. And talking to that man, Walter Kaiser, who was giving the Bible studies at the Billy Graham Center dedication a few weeks ago, and I talked to him a little about his book, and every chapter uses the word promise. And he feels that this Abrahamic promise is a key continuity to the whole Old Testament. And so I said to him, well, why do you call it promise? Because after all, it's also a command. He said, well, that's what the New Testament calls it, the promise. And we had a little bit of a discussion. I said, yes, but the people in the New Testament, like the people in the Old Testament, fondly look back to this promise. Only seeing a promise, they didn't want to see the command. And Dawson used to say, you know, that a lot of people are experts in the precious promises of the Bible. I can still hear him saying that. But who's going to find the challenging commands, you know? These are his words. And it's true. They usually go together, the promise and the command. And then as we read the Bible, we tend in the promise and skip over the command. And so it is with this. And so the very reference to this passage as a promise is itself a partial abbreviation of what's here. He said to me then, and he said, well, if you wanted, you could call this the Great Commission. And I had been thinking the same thing myself, but I wouldn't have dared say it. And I didn't put the words in his mouth. I said, look, can I quote you? Have you got that in print? He says, you quote me and I'll get it in print. And I'm quoting him. You put it down that the Great Commission was not given for the first time by Jesus Christ. Jesus came, in a sense, not to give the Great Commission, but to take it away. Take it away from a nation that had it for 2,000 years. A nation that was not just given that commission as an intellectual game to be put on the shelf as a hibernating mandate, which would be dug up later when Jesus brought it off the shelf and said, now it's time to obey this commission. No, this nation had been commanded from the beginning to obey that commission. Now you say, well, but there's no evidence that they ever obeyed it. The whole Old Testament is oblivious of that commission. The whole Old Testament is not oblivious of it. The missionary Bible of the Apostle Paul was the Old Testament. When Peter in Acts 3 gave reason for his reaching out to the Gentiles, he quoted Genesis 12:3 in Acts 3:25. He quoted the Great Commission. When Paul gave a reason for what he was doing to the Galatians, he quoted Genesis 12:3 in Galatians 3:8. He quoted the Great Commission. When Paul faced the increasingly restive bunch of Jews in Antioch of Pisidia, the first place there is a recorded sermon of Paul, those people had to be convinced that the Great Commission was valid. And he didn't quote the New Testament. He quoted Isaiah 49:6. Isaiah 49:6 I have thought of for many years. Ironically, for many years I've thought of Isaiah 49:6 as the best overall statement of the Great Commission in the Bible. I've said it hundreds of times. But it was only a year and a half ago that I realized it wasn't just something that was mentioned for future reference. But it was and it had been a command that was supposed to be obeyed then and there. Now, the reason why I think Isaiah 49:6 is so great is because it tells what isn't the Great Commission. The first half of the verse says, the salvation of your nation is not the Great Commission. It's a relatively secondary matter. If you will allow me to make a free translation, I'll just tell you that I would translate that. Now, I don't know. In this particular verse, it's the King James that is the best translation of all the modern versions I've consulted. In fact, if you're using a modern version that translates that verse, it is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel. You've got a bum translation. The survival of the nation Israel, or of our nation, is not too light a thing for God. It is, as the King James puts it, it's a light thing. Now, that's not good modern English. If you want to translate the sense of it properly, it would say something like this. It is a relatively secondary matter that your nation should be preserved. The more important commission, and it goes on in part B, is that I want you to be a light And if your version says nations, cross it out and write in Gentiles, like the King James has. The word nation is an even-handed word. All nations are the same. The word Gentiles is the other guys, the people who don't rate, who don't count. And God sent us to the people that don't rate and that don't count. See, he didn't just send us to all the nice nations of the world. He sent us to the Gentiles. I want you to be a light to the Gentiles, that my salvation may go to the ends of the earth. Now, this, of course, is simply a paraphrase of Genesis 12:3. Let me go back. Genesis 12:3 is not just a little accidental verse you trip over and go on as if nothing happened. It is repeated in 18:18. It is repeated again and again. It might be an interesting lesson for you to trace this through Genesis. In 28:14, you find this full-blown again. In fact, it even adds a phrase that apparently Jesus quoted in the Great Commission of Matthew 28:19-20. It says, "And lo, I will be with you always." Now, those very same exact Greek words are in the Septuagint and in Romans 28:20. Now, I'm not going to stand up here and say that Jesus was quoting the Septuagint, but he was saying exactly what the Septuagint said. And I really believe that there is a direct association, certainly in the mind of Peter, certainly in the mind of Paul, and I believe in the mind of Jesus Christ as well. He was not coming to tell them something new. Guess what? The parable he gave them, after all, was a story of repeated messengers coming to get their due, to find out that this nation had been obedient. And each time those messengers are thrown out or beaten or killed. And so finally, you see, with the same mission, God sends, the landowner sends his own son. And they see him at a distance and they say, "Aha, if we get rid of the heir, then this will be our own." And the most dastardly, the most hopeless act of mankind was to put to death the Son of God, thinking that they no longer would be required to fulfill their destiny under God. Oh no, the kingdom, as the kingdom strikes back, the empire of God's will reinvades the occupied territory of this planet. There is no resistance ultimately to this. Not even the gates of hell will prevail. I always thought that the gates of hell were somehow after us, but you stopped and think about that. The gates of hell are not chasing us. We're contesting the gates of hell, and we are not going to fail. The fact is, the powers of darkness and of Satan, as malignant and as ugly and as violent as they are and as deceptive as they are, like the sin that does so easily beset us is like the anesthetizing of the mosquito, that he doesn't draw blood without first anesthetizing. And the deceitfulness of sin in Satan's operation is that of the vampire that anesthetizes first and then draws blood. And our weakness, you know, Saul wist not that the Lord had departed from him. It's a subtle, fantastic foe that we have. But we are not going to fail. We can contest his power and push back that darkness. Now here's a little footnote from anthropology. In the Bible, the word darkness shouldn't be interpreted in terms of modern physical science, where, you know, we understand darkness to be simply the absence of light. These biblical metaphors are not meant to be used in scientific form. We don't go with the light out into the darkness where, you know, you walk with a candle into a darkened room and the light just jumps back. Oh, no. You walk into, where is it, France or any other place, and you walk in the door with that candle and the light will be blown out or the candle will be torn out of your hands. This is an active, powerful darkness. It's not the absence of light merely. The darkness, you know, the light came into the world and the darkness has not overcome it. Modern physical science type darkness doesn't overcome anything. Have you ever heard of darkness overcoming something in science? Can you imagine someone going to the store and saying, I want a flashlight? And they say, do you want a light flashlight or a dark flashlight? And he says, I want a dark one. So he has a flashlight that you push the button and a shaft of darkness goes out and it will, a person will disappear in the darkness or a, you know. That isn't the way it works, but it is the way it works in the Bible. Darkness is a malignant power. And the contest of the light with darkness is more than distributing tracts out of airplanes or whatever. Now, so this continuous story happens to be a rather sad story because this nation is not all that faithful. Abraham, in the very same chapter, is off on a missionary journey to Egypt. Now you say, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Abraham didn't go to Egypt as a missionary. Well, he didn't think he did. But most missionaries of history have not gone thinking that that's what they were doing. Joseph didn't go to Egypt thinking he was going to be a missionary. But he said to his brothers later, you sold me, but God sent me. And he was a very great blessing to Egypt. You know, the commission here is that Abraham, being promised a blessing, God promised to bless him. And now we have a heresy sweeping American evangelicals called the hundredfold blessing. That if you'll give $10, God will give you back $1,000, sweeping many parts of the country. It's the prosperity fever. We used to read with shock at Reverend Ike. Now you can't distinguish the difference between Reverend Ike's messages and many evangelical emphases today. My secretary, who's on furlough as a missionary, has over the years been associated with a certain class, adult class at Lake Avenue Congregational Church, where I'm a member, the only church I've ever been a member of. And so I'm not criticizing somebody else's church when I go on with this story. She has been increasingly shocked as the furloughs come. This is their third furlough. Now these young people that they grew up with and from whose midst they went out as missionaries and who have faithfully supported them, these young people are now wealthy people. Not just one swimming pool, two swimming pools. Some people like colder than others. Now, isn't that nice? Two Cadillacs in the driveway. Here's a family that has two jets. Now, so one of these families, you know, they were naturally, when they first came back just a few weeks ago, they were being circulated around to meet all the little small groups where they pray and read the Bible. And so in these homes, you know, and one of these people, longtime friends of theirs, said, say, tell us more about Costa Rica. Is there any land down there available? Well, I suppose, you know, it's a fairly small country, but there are not very many people. There's probably some land. Well, what do you want? Well, we're just thinking maybe buying a couple of thousand acres and, what are you trying to do? Put up an orphanage or something? Oh, no, just a place to go and to just relax, you know. Wouldn't that be nice? Buy a couple of thousand acres in Costa Rica and go and relax. Because the Lord has blessed us. And he expects us to respond with gratitude to the blessings he's given. My daughter came home, Sunday. She's off at college in the week. But she said in the Sunday school class they were talking about some verse of the Bible. You know, you got it. Hand it to the Bible. The Bible keeps bringing the subject up all the time about poor people and so forth. And this one fellow in the class, his father was a seminary classmate of mine at Fuller Seminary, Bill Giancarella. He was a former chemist. He went to seminary. He didn't really turn out to be a pastor. He went back into engineering, and he's a very wealthy man now. And his son is in my daughter's class. That works out, doesn't it? So He says to her, you know, my father's brother flies out here from New York to Palm Springs for on the weekends, quite often. There's anything wrong with that, he says. And so my daughter said, well, I might be something more urgent to do with the money than that. But don't you believe God expects us to use our blessings and to enjoy them? Why would he give them to us? And she said, well, maybe he gave the blessings to you to share with somebody else. Now, is that so difficult to understand from this passage, which says, and you will be a blessing, and it says it again, you will be a blessing to all the families of the earth. Families of the earth, we're talking about the nations, not the countries. There it is. Now, what does this require? It requires more than, and I'm at the risk of being misunderstood, it requires more than the gospel. And I say that because we don't understand the full meaning of the gospel, because this text here and the other texts all the way through the Bible never allow us to believe that the gospel is merely a message. It is the light fighting against evil and the oppression of our world today. It's an ugly business. Paul was beaten and killed, and the very first sermon that he preached led him into difficulty, and they formed a hit squad, and they sent him and tracked him three cities down and killed him. They thought they did, and dragged him out of the city because it would have been a misdemeanor to leave a dead body in the city. Now that's the way the believers treated Paul when he mentioned the nations, the other people. That was his first recorded sermon. Isn't it interesting that Jesus' first recorded sermon goes along very nicely? And everybody thinks it's just great. You know, the literal translation always leaves you cold. Beautiful words were coming out of his mouth. I imagine it was more like, you know, ain't he great, some sort of thing. But then all of a sudden, their smiles turn to frowns. And these people rose up with fury and grabbed the man who had been brought up in their midst and were trying to kill him. What did he do? He mentioned two Gentiles whom God had blessed, the widow of Zarephath and Naaman the Syrian. And that's all it took. Imagine their tempers were on edge there in Galilee of the Gentiles, almost like an occupied part of Palestine. They didn't feel as much at home. They hated these people, like the wetbacks in San Diego type of thing. See, get these people out of here. Or like a fine Christian woman in my living room the other day said, we don't have to take these refugees in. But God said that we're to be a blessing. Now, interestingly enough, it's exactly what God gives us that we're supposed to give to the other people. And God did not just give us a Gospel of John. He gave these people, they thought, two Cadillacs and two swimming pools and two jets and 2,000 acres in Costa Rica. They thought God was giving that to them. I don't think he was. He was entrusting it to them. Now, this theme, of course, the plot thickens. Why is this nation so oblivious of its commission? People say, well, there couldn't have been a commission in the Old Testament because the people didn't obey a commission. On the same grounds, you can say that there's no commission in the Bible at all, because in the next 2,000 years, you don't find anybody obeying that commission. William Carey, in the year 1800, roughly, had to reinstate the Great Commission. The reformers didn't find it in the Bible. They studied the Bible for 300 years and never ran across the Great Commission, in a sense. They reinterpreted it. So it didn't apply. And so it is with Israel. They reinterpreted all this. They said, God has promised to bless us. He's promised to bless us. He's promised to bless us. They didn't realize that unto whomsoever much is given of them shall much be required. And they had been entrusted. And Exodus 19, 5 and 6 shows that God was intending them to be a nation of priests, to reach out to the other nations as an intermediary nation, like a priest is an intermediary. And all the way through, you find reminders of this. God tells him, you're not getting out of Egypt because you're such a great or wonderful nation, but so that my glory will be seen in all the earth. God was rescuing the nation that he had intended to be the light to the nations. They were just horrified by survival problems. And so they were trying to save themselves, and they lost their lives. They all died in the wilderness. 10 times in faithlessness, they turned away from God's command. And finally, he said in Numbers 14, look, I'm not going to change my plans. My glory shall fill the earth. Numbers 14:25. But you will not be the ones to carry this glory to the ends of the earth. You are going to all be wiped out. No, 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 they said. We'll go back. And they ran up there. Of course, it was too late, and they got clobbered, and they milled around, and they died, all but Caleb and Joshua in the wilderness, because they were unwilling to follow through. They were, and the curious thing is there in Numbers 14, they said, if we go up against these giants, we'll be killed. We'll die. And God said, what you feared will happen to you. And they did die in the wilderness. In other words, the survival, the clutching, the hoarding of the blessings is a futile exercise. America, trying to arm itself sufficiently and stave off the nations, this is a futile exercise. The Bible tells us so. All the way through, as this nation was willing to obey God, preserved it and protected it by means far beyond their own. And when they were concerned about their own defense, concerned to save themselves, unwilling to share what they had, they were unfair to the stranger within their gates, representing the other nations, unfair to the widows and the poor people too. You see, when they were not sharing their blessings, God took all their blessings away, and there are no passages anywhere in all of world's literature that describe such devastation. One example. A woman waiting for her baby to be born and going furtively away from others so that she could eat the baby before the family got a hold of it to eat. This is a pretty grim passage. You don't find this in our sex novels today. This book talks about degradation and judgment upon God's chosen people in a scale that should make Americans tremble in their boots, in their ski boots, in their $50, $150 boots. They should tremble in these boots, because what God has entrusted to them, they're using up on themselves. You know, you've all heard stories about heaven. I made up a story myself. I didn't hear the right one, so I had to make it up. A lot of people got there at the same time, and they were crowding through, and they had to be processed, so they put them off in a side room there, which happened to be a room where they had lots of filing cabinets, and this one man was sitting there, and he was looking at these cabinets. He noticed that it was an alphabetical series, and that it was right about there that his own last name occurred. So he looked around. He talked to one of the angels. He says, could I look in this drawer here? It looks like my name is in here. And he says, sure, we don't have any secrets. So he looks in there, and sure enough, he finds a folder that describes minutely every use of money he's made in his life. And he reads it, and he reads it, and he reads it. All of a sudden, he's stunned. He doesn't find any reference to the money he's given to the church. He calls the angel over, and he says, look. He says, I've given thousands of dollars to the church. I've given to missions. I've given to, all the things I've done, it's not in this folder. And the angel says, that's true. We only keep track of what you've spent on yourself. And this story unfolds in such a way that we can compare any nation to the 2,000-year story of this nation. And all of a sudden, the 80% of the Bible becomes relevant again. It isn't a place where you go and to get peanuts and raisins and M&Ms and little nice verses out of it. The whole story is there before us. The appalling story of the obedience and the disobedience of a nation to the Great Commission. And see, that's how much of the Bible you lose if you don't understand the Old Testament as not just sort of outmoded, but the beginning of the story. It is the only full-blown account of a missionary nation. And all of a sudden you see America. And you see the Armenians. The Armenians were the first nation outside of Israel to receive the blessings of God as a nation. And you know the Armenian nation? They haven't sent very many missionaries. And their trials and tribulations have been very similar to the Jews. God is very rough on those who receive a great deal. Not because he's a rough God, but because he's a just God. Unto whomsoever much is given, of them shall much be required. Now you see, when we as a country, with 80% of all the Bible-trained people in the world, are sitting on our wealth and oblivious even to the refugees within our own country, how under the sun are we going to be able to say, well, now God isn't as rough as he used to be? So you get in the New Testament, and here's the situation. This nation coming back from its second major missionary trip. The first one was to Egypt as a nation. And what it left behind in Israel and in Egypt, we'll probably never fully know. But there were some evidences of a bleeding through of biblical revelation into Egypt. There are some secular psalms in Egypt that are similar to the psalms in the Bible. There's some evidence that maybe Akhenaten, one of these pharaohs, caught his monotheism from this reluctant missionary force in their midst. Who knows? I don't know. We'll have to wait to find out. Later, this same nation was forced off into another missionary journey to Babylon. Now, you know, I used to think that that was just punishment. But it wasn't just punishment. God was sending them where they were supposed to go in the first place. Well, I must confess, until recently, I never thought of that in missionary terminology. The diaspora, one of those 25-cent words you learn in seminary so that the people can't understand you, meaning the dispersion of the Jewish people across the whole Roman Empire and all across Asia even. This dispersion was enforced because they were unwilling to go voluntarily. And all down through history, the history of missions mainly is the involuntary passing on of the blessings of God. When we hold on, God tears them out of our hands. He sends us abroad. He sends others into our midst so that you see two major missionary mechanisms from Abraham on. The going and the coming. The going voluntarily and the going involuntarily. The coming voluntarily and the coming involuntarily. What's an example of these things? Jonah, maybe, sort of voluntarily, scared to death if he didn't, was a missionary, voluntarily. But others were involuntary missionaries, like Joseph. Then there were those who came voluntarily, like the Queen of Sheba. She was impressed to come, and more impressed when she came. What did she learn? We don't fully know. There was Ruth, who came voluntarily. She was caught up in this God of Israel. And there was Naaman the Syrian, who came voluntarily. But what about, how did Naaman get witness to in the first place? Because a little girl had been carried off captive involuntarily. And most missionaries have been involuntarily carried off captive, like the Jews to Egypt or to Babylon. But then there are people who come involuntarily, like the people who replaced the northern kingdom in 2 Kings 17, where five nations were brought in to populate what later was to be called Samaria. And no wonder was considered heathen, because these people had been transported in to take the place of the vacuum left by the deported 10 northern tribes. And they said, hey, we don't know about the God of this land, and the lions are eating us up. Send us back a priest from where the Assyrians had sent them. So they did. They sent a priest back to tell them. And they got the Torah in their hands. And to this day, the oldest copy of the first five books of the Bible are in the hands of, 600 remaining Samaritans. There they are, involuntarily coming into Revelation. Now, these four mechanisms in the early church, in the Roman period, for example, they didn't send any missionaries out, except they exiled the people who had the wrong theology. Sort of like Jehovah's Witnesses being thrown out of the United States, only that's not the reason they're going. There are a lot more heretical missionaries from this country than Orthodox missionaries, by the way. And so the Goths, those tribal peoples north of the Roman Empire, they imbibed a very poor Christology. They were half-baked Christians when they invaded the empire and knocked it down. The whole western part of the Roman Empire was knocked down by partially Christianized tribal people who had the wrong gospel, or at least defective gospel, because nobody but heretics were sent to them. Ulfilas, one of the earliest of all missionaries. We don't know whether he was taken captive as a Christian or he was a Gothic youth taken captive by Christians, but whatever, that enforced mechanism brought the gospel to the Goths. And the story is that he translated the whole Bible into the Gothic language. He skipped 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, because he figured that the Goths didn't need to know any more about war. But he did translate the other parts of the Bible. Anyway, all down through history you see this. One of the terrifying things is that not only the Goths invaded to get the faith, because the Romans didn't reach out, but the Goths, once Christians, Germans and French and so forth, Franks, these tribal peoples, once they were Christianized, they didn't send missionaries further north into the Scandinavian area. And so those people invaded to get the faith. And they carried off young women, just like Naaman the Syrian's young woman in his household. And it was more than any other missionary mechanism, those young women carried back as concubines and slaves and wives who kept the faith and delivered the blessings of Abraham, the gospel of Jesus Christ, to those Scandinavian savages called Vikings. Probably some of the most crude, savage peoples ever known in the annals of history. And yet they were brought to Christ by a backwards missionary mechanism. And then they became Christians. They straightened around their hats and they became the Crusaders. And these were pretty rough missionaries, these Crusaders. They had to recruit, you know. They recruited people. They moved up the Rhine, south up the Rhine, picking up recruits and hangers-on and sweeping people out of the jails and stuff. And on they went, and pretty soon they had enough boldness and power to contest the people that killed Jesus Christ. They dragged all the Jews out of the towns, into the town square, and rode their horses over them until they were just a bloody pulp. That was just a warm-up for the missionary challenge of the Middle East. And then further to warm up, when they passed through that great Christian city of Constantinople, they sacked that too, just for good measure, to practice up, you know. These were pretty rough missionaries. And any organization today that calls itself a crusade ought to, you know, stay out of the Middle East anyway. And it is probably to our discredit that the Wheaton football team is called the Crusaders. Not just the Crusaders. There it is on that gym wall, the Fighting Crusaders. But it just shows you that the Great Commission can be obeyed miserably as well as effectively. And on down through history you see this pattern of very reluctant outreach. The Great Commission was not quoted very often. you take a tape recorder to every church this coming Sunday in America, and it's a very slim chance that in 5 churches out of 350,000, you would find any reference to the Great Commission. It's the same today as it was then. People love the blessings, but they are not interested in passing those blessings on. History really is relatively simple once you get the main story clear. If you don't have the main story clear, it will be very, very complicated. History, the very word, strikes terror into my heart. I never appreciated history. I hate history. I've always hated history. But I am interested in what happened. And, now, we don't know a lot about what happened before 4,000 years ago. Now, the cross of Christ comes right in the middle of what we know about history. We know more about Abraham than any other man who lived that long ago. That's a rather interesting thing. And, of course, he's the main character as the opening story of the Kingdom Strikes Back begins to unfold. And all this, you know, there's 40 centuries there. You can't remember what happened in 40 centuries, so just don't try. Let's break this down into four, call them super centuries or mega centuries if you want. What did I say? Excuse me, 10. We'll put 5 in the Old Testament and 5 in the post-apostolic period. Now, that's not going to be too hard. This is pretty easy. This is the patriarchs. This is the captivity. This is the judges. This is the kings. And this is the post-exilic period. That's another fancy word you learn in seminary. Get your money's worth. Now, here, of course, they were deported to Egypt for 400 years. Here for 70 years. This is God's missionary outreach, enforced missionary outreach, both to the south and to the east. Now, the northern kingdom was taken away and dispersed into the dispersion. This is another missionary technique, not just a punishment, but a missionary technique on God's part. Before Christ, for 150 years, the Pharisees had been missionaries. Jesus refers to this phenomenon by the fact that, by the fact that the Pharisees traversed land and sea to make a single hypocrite, proselyte. So that it's possible to be a missionary and merely mold people into American habits and customs and say, hey, we've got some nice Christians now. That's what was being quoted. You know, you don't go to France to make Protestant disciples. And so it's perfectly possible as we look here to realize that God was moving the people one way or another. People were coming to Israel too. But it is really, really inadequate to say that the Old Testament, and I'm going to use another seminary word here, was a centripetal period when, according to God's plan, Israel was supposed to be a lighthouse nation and attract the world to their doorstep. And then in the New Testament, it's a centrifugal commission, and they're supposed to go out. Nonsense! They were supposed to go, and God actually sent them many times. And it's both centripetal and centrifugal. Why should God switch the tables? See? Is there any overarching reason to believe that, you know, nobody went out in this period either? So why don't we call this centripetal? Well, anyway, okay, so Christ appears and definitively restates with ultimate, absolute authority what God had said in the first place. But with no greater authority, Jesus didn't have any greater authority than the Father who spoke to Abraham, right? He was simply restating and getting the thing back on tracks again, and now other nations were forced, the gospel was torn out of their hands, The biblical image is the branches were chopped off, other branches were grafted in, until the times of the Gentiles, the other nations, would be fulfilled. Okay? And so on down here, what are the other nations? The Romans. Now these are 400 years, 800 years, 1200 years, 1600 years, 2000. Now these are not precisely 400 years. I would write down the exact dates except that the scholars can't even agree. But they're roughly 400 year periods, these five periods here. These 400 year periods are just a little more precise. The Romans. In 410 was the beginning of the end of the Roman Empire. And then the people who pushed it down got the gospel by invading, and they were the Germans, if you want to call them that, or the Goths, the Germans. And then the Vikings. Each time, it's an invasion process that gives the gospel out. And then in this period here, the Crusades. Trying to go out, but by a very poor method. By the end of the period, there really were valid missionaries going, and in this final period, you call this the ends of the earth. Because really, the gospel has gone to the ends of the earth in a geographical sense. But as we've learned already, geography isn't what God is interested in. God is not interested in mountains and rivers, which is the basis of political boundaries. He's not even interested in political structures. He's interested in the people, the peoples, plural, those cultural groups within the countries of the world. Now, in each of these periods, the period begins with outrageous paganism and ends up with 100 years of flourishing Christianity. At the end of each of these periods, this period, Rome actually became officially Christian before the end of this fourth 100-year period here. This is the Carolingian Renaissance. Now, between these two flourishing periods was the Dark Ages, the first Dark Ages, when these Germanic tribes moved in chaos for centuries. And the second Dark Age is when the Vikings moved in. Now, if you read a book that talks about the Dark Ages, you know that they're glossing over a great Christian Renaissance between those two periods as the gospel moved further and further out. And it was, by the way, the gospel was the Bible. It was the Bible which not just illuminated people, but commanded them to obey the living God. Paul spoke of bringing about obedience to the faith. See, this isn't what evangelicals usually preach. The Bible has more than just an invitation to it. All right, and then the great calamity in this period was the plague, which killed off a third of all the people in Europe and about 9/10 of the Christian leaders, because they're the ones who visited the sick. And then there's the great flourishing period, which includes, but not merely, the Reformation. Now, the Reformation, we all think of ourselves, most of us, as products of the Reformation. The Reformation must be seen in terms of nations and missionary strategy. The Reformation occurred in a geographical and cultural area of the world. Now, it's wonderful that we're all gifted in many ways. I happen to be a great artist. I'll draw a picture of Europe. Here's Spain and Italy and Greece and Turkey and North Africa like that. And here's England and Ireland, okay? Now, the Roman Empire, there's a sea in here. Now, the Rhine flowed north and up in and petered out in the Alps. Over here, you had this body of water here. The Danube flowed east from the Alps. Those two rivers were the northern boundary of the Roman Empire for a great deal of the time. And beyond them, held at bay, were all these scurrilous tribal peoples that were out of it. You know, our ancestors, most of us. As the Romans never really culturally Romanized that territory. And so when the gospel began pushing up into this area, and by the way, there's another famous misunderstanding. The Roman Church, you know, has rewritten history for its own benefit, and the Protestants haven't cared too much about the early centuries, so they just slurp it up. But the idea is that Augustine went as a missionary to England in 596 A.D. Well, that's true. He did go as a missionary to India, to England, in 596 A.D. The only catch is that there were missionaries coming the other way long before that, and down in northern Italy, as early as 560, there were missionaries from Ireland and Scotland and England going the other way. So what was Augustine up to? He was taking a Roman faith into a Celtic variety of Christianity, which was a little different. And it was a competition between two Christianities, not between light and darkness. Although it is true that there were a lot of new Anglo-Saxons in this area, and they were being won by both forces. But the major achievement was from the north. These were mission field Christians. It's like this group of Presbyterians, 23,000 in western Burma. Now, Burma, you know, is Baptist. You wouldn't expect any Presbyterians in Burma. And out of, what should I say, courtesy, why the Presbyterians have stayed out of Burma and the Baptists went in, and, you know, the various mainline denominations have parceled out the earth's surface. And so how did those Presbyterians get there? Mizos came across the border from India, from Mizoram, which is 98% Christian. And they became Christians from the Khasi Hills, where Welsh missionaries, who happened to be Presbyterians, and then these poor folks didn't know any better, and they became Presbyterians. Now, that's sort of the way it is here. These were mission field Christians, and their main skill was the Bible. They treated the Bible with more care, not just embellishing its pages with holy reverence, but in reading and studying and writing commentaries on the Bible than any other nation in history has ever done in terms of focus and primary concern. And they were the missionaries of the first 1,200 years of post-Christian history, of history beyond Christ. And so there were these, you know, Christianizing forces. But there came a day when the Roman influence more or less trampled over all this, and a great deal of Christianity became at least superficially Roman, and Latin was the language. You had to speak Latin if you're going to be a Christian. But there came a day when somebody said, hey, why do we have to speak Latin? The person who said this was Luther. He was way off in East Germany, up in the forest, you know, and he made a trip to Rome. When he was down in Rome, he saw what the people who really spoke Latin properly were really like, and he didn't like it. They saw him coming. They could detect by his accent that he was a Tedesco, which is like WAP or JAP or something like that. And so, man, he really felt alienated and excluded. And you know, going up those stairs on his knees, you know, something clicked. And though he had come down there, you know, as a German Christian, he went back as a Christian German. And the German language was going to be good enough. And so all of this territory that the Roman Empire had never really Romanized peeled off, and it's called the Reformation. Now, just because they weren't Roman, does that mean they were more Christian? We've assumed so. But the so-called Reformation was a phenomenon that swept north and south. The Reformation was, in fact, mainly in the south. Thousands of Bible study groups in Italy and Spain and France, more than in Germany. The Germans just were German in addition. And the Bible gave them their liberty, their cultural liberty. It's like the blacks of this country waking up all of a sudden saying, hey, we don't have to be white. Or the Hispanics or somebody else. And so these people woke up, and the Reformation was simply a nationalization process of breaking away from the missionary culture. Now, I go into that little detail because it'll give you a few clues. We've been told by one method or another that the Reformation occurred because the Catholics were suppressing the Bible. And Luther broke the Bible out and translated it into German so that people could understand it. How many have had that general impression? Well, I've got news for you. The Bible had been translated into German already. Not just the New Testament, the whole Bible. 14 different times Luther's was the 15th translation. And the Bible was suppressed, not just by the Catholics, but by the Protestants, who soon discovered that it was an instrument of liberty and political unrest. And so the Bible was in the doghouse from the Reformation on. So that you might say that the Reformation did not result from the suppression of the Bible, but the suppression of the Bible resulted from the Reformation. Because the so-called Reformation, when we say it as Protestants, means the breakaway of the northern Germanic peoples. Whereas the real Reformation was a biblical Reformation growing up with thousands of little Bible study groups believing and preaching justification by faith in Italy before Luther. But boy, that doctrine became really out of style when Luther showed how it could be used for political rebellion. Now, I'm not solving all your problems for you, but I just want to stir up your imagination a little. And so, on down through history, you have the reaction of peoples against peoples, and the gospel is crossing over bridges into these other areas of people. And it's a story that has a fantastic series of repetitions of people receiving the blessings of God, refusing to give it away, God tearing it out of their hands by one method or another, by dispersing them or by sending invaders. It's almost a dreary process. And I have speculated, I have thought to myself, I wonder if the only way the Chinese or the Russians or the Muslims are going to get the gospel is by invading America. Don't look now, but it may be very shortly that over half of all the property in this country will be owned by foreigners. Even now, I was just reading on the plane yesterday, something like $350 billion worth of foreign investment, officially $80 billion, actually more like $350 billion. You know, the Japanese couldn't conquer Pearl Harbor by force. They simply came and bought it. They bought the Hawaiian Islands. They own and they operate the Hawaiian Islands today. It's just a joke in the Hawaiian Islands. Everybody knows this is true. They can buy America too. We do not have any real security whatsoever in terms of preserving the goods that we have. And God can easily take these things away from us. We either have to give them away or we will have them taken away. There is no way to seek to save our lives and not lose them. This, it seems to me, is the overarching theme not only of the Bible, but of the next 20 centuries as you push across this perspective right down to the present day. Now, the story of the kingdom striking back, nevertheless, is also a significant, has a positive side as well as a negative side. And more and more and more people are hearing about Christ. If there are 1,000 new churches every week in this world, it's not because the Christian movement is going backwards. There is no country of the world, now I'm speaking of countries, there's no country of the world where the population rate of growth is faster than the Christian population rate of growth in that same country. Now, I'm sure you've heard other things. The church around the world, I was complaining to Ken Taylor not so long ago, printed the very opposite. It said, in every country of the world, non-Christians are growing faster than the Christians. And I was in his office and I said, you know, Ken, do you really think that's right? I think it's really exactly the opposite. What is the evidence? Well, there's so many non-Christians, they've got to grow faster. I know, but you're talking about fast, you're talking about rate. And rate of growth means, at the end of a year, is the Christian percentage bigger or smaller? Now, Waldron Scott in his book talks about the increasing gap. But what he mostly doesn't refer to is the fact that the poorer people of the world, in most cases, are actually getting wealthier, despite most dreary reports, even though the gap is getting bigger. Just like the gap in the number of people who are non-Christians in India today is something like 500 million, when, you know, 50 years ago, there were only 200 million non-Christians in India. And the Christians haven't grown by 300 million. So how could we ever be catching up? But 50 years ago, the Christians were less than 1%. And today, they're 3%. We are not losing out, you see. And so it goes. The kingdom strikes back. This is not a losing battle. Closure means we think in terms of finishing the task, not just getting over 15 laborers per year in every country of the world. This is a means to the end. But let's keep the end in view. The end of missions is the penetration of every nation of the earth. This gospel must first be published among all nations, not countries, and then shall the end come. I'm not predicting the return at any given point. I am suggesting that we cannot be very hopeful that we've done our job if we haven't done at least what that verse commands us to do, and which, of course, is here in Genesis. It's the same story all through the Bible and all through history. The most important question of political history is the simple question, has this country, has this nation been blessed by God? And if so, what is it doing with the blessings it's received? Now that, I believe, is the overall picture of 40 centuries, of 10 super centuries. And perhaps there'll be some questions this afternoon. I'll try, if possible, to pick up from this point and talk about the present situation. Maybe I'll slot back a few years this evening to talk about where we stand in terms of this battle called The Kingdom Strikes Back tonight. Thank you very much.